Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course if you're out there across America, why, you can always call us at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line from the eastern part of the United States, Mr. Rowan Scarborough. We're going to be talking about his book, Rumsfeld's War. Mr. Scarborough, thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure.
And, of course, this is an entirely different audience. I've got about 10 stations or so listening, so they haven't heard your story before. So please don't feel that you have to avoid anything that you've said before in our conversations.
All right, I'll let it fly.
Well, anyway, the book is the story of Donald Rumsfeld, the man who really is running the war in Iraq, who ran the war in Iran, and he's really a fascinating individual. Mr. Scarborough has a tremendous ability to get information. Apparently he's covered the Pentagon for a long period of time. He knows a lot of people there. He's accumulated a lot of information. Why did you zero in on Rumsfeld? Why is he so important today?
Well, you know, these are really historic times that our country is in. Great historic times, I would say. We've commenced World War III in many ways. We're fighting a global war. We're fighting several hot local wars. And when you look at where our troops are and the way they're fighting, you would have to say it's being done the way this man, Donald Rumsfeld, wants them to be there and fight. So I decided about a year ago that I ought to do a book on this guy to try to document how he did it, how he consolidated power in the Pentagon, how he won turf battles with the White House, and a little bit about his life, which is really a rather remarkable tale from his upbringing in Illinois to the pinnacle of power in Washington. So I thought it would be a compelling story, so that's why I started the research.
And it really is a compelling story. Donald Rumsfeld is the youngest Secretary of Defense America's ever had. He's also the oldest Secretary of Defense America's ever had, because he's been Secretary of Defense twice. But, of course, he knows how to work within the bureaucracy. And apparently there were all sorts of problems when the Bush administration first got into office as to who was really going to run the military. Some people wanted it handled out of the White House, and Condoleezza Rice and the new department they'd created there. And how did Donald Rumsfeld get it to the point where he was in charge?
Well, you know, he fought after 9/11, and he decided very early on that he wanted to fight a global war against Al-Qaeda, something that we had never done before. The Pentagon, even though Islamists had attacked our interest several times over the past 20 years, we had never used the military to go after them in any significant way. We had always used the CIA or law enforcement. So after 9/11, Rumsfeld decides that he wants to fight a global war. And he commences to do that, to make the plans. And in November of 01, this is less than 2 months after 9/11, he finds out that Condoleezza Rice is trying a power move at the White House.
And, of course, he counters that very effectively. And after his countering, he ends up the man who's really in charge. And he's going to remake our American military. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment as we get back here from bringing in some other stations. All right, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Rowan Scarborough. His book, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander. So how did he deal with the generals? You know, usually why the Secretary of Defense is a figurehead, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the generals run the wars. So why was this different, and how was he able to do what he did?
Well, you know, when he came in, before 9/11, and he became Defense Secretary in January of 01, he had a mission to transform the military because there was a feeling, accurate, that the military had never quite adjusted to the end of the Soviet Union and the beginning of new threats out in the world like terrorism and proliferation and drugs, illegal drugs, and they were still in a Cold War mentality. So he wanted to change all of those things, but he didn't trust the people in place that he inherited. So he essentially ignored them when he came into the building. He set up advisory panels made up of people that he trusted from outside the Pentagon. And then he started sending out memos, the snowflakes that he calls them, or that are called by the people who get them, asserting his civilian control over the military. He then proceeds to take an active role in who gets promoted in the Pentagon, something a defense secretary had never done so deep into the bureaucracy as Rumsfeld began to do. And all these things had a cumulative effect so that after about a year, he began to take control, putting his people where they wanted him, getting rid of the officers that he didn't want. And so it became more of Rumsfeld's place about a year after he took over. But what he did significantly with Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor, was that she wanted the NSC to have a strong role in the war. And she had Bush sign a secret directive that had never been disclosed before my book, that gave her broad powers to run the war on terrorism. And Rumsfeld finds out about this after the fact, and alarm bells go off. So he sits down and writes a secret memo to Miss Rice that I have included in my book, something that has never been disclosed before. And he tells her that what she's trying to do is illegal and dangerous, and that it threatens to get between him and his commanders and him and the president. So the memo goes over to the White House from Rumsfeld, and this is really an inside look at how he fights these bureaucratic wars. And A debate ensues.
Hold that thought just one moment there. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Scarborough is telling us about Donald Rumsfeld now has a debate. The question is, who is going to run the war on terrorism? Condoleezza Rice wants to run this through her office, and Donald Rumsfeld lets her know, and I'm sure the president know in certain terms, that he expects to be in charge.
Exactly. So he sends the memo to Miss Rice accusing her of trying to usurp his power, and they have a big debate. And Cheney, Vice President Cheney, sides with Rumsfeld, and in the end Bush does too. And it's decided that Bush and not the National Security Council staff are going to play the major role in where our troops go in this war and how they fight. And we know Rumsfeld wins because my sources told me so, but also a couple months later, the four-star retired general who was brought in to coordinate the war on terrorism abruptly resigns, and he tells friends afterwards that he never had the power that he thought he was going to have. So this was an important win for Rumsfeld. It allowed him to put troops where he wanted them, the way he wanted them, without interference from the NSC. And this is one of the reasons that I call the book Rumsfeld's War.
Well, what was so interesting to me, and I think that to our listeners, I hope, was his whole outlook on fighting wars was entirely different than that of the military. The military was left over from the Second World War, and you were going to have, you know, the large tank battles. You were going to have a lot of soldiers on the ground. You were going to fight it with a lot of soldiers. He wanted to use special forces units, trained, highly trained teams made up of perhaps a dozen men or more, and these would begin coordinating, taking the battle to the enemy, working behind the lines, men who could speak the language, who were professionals, highly professional, using air support, and they would be able to inflict a devastating toll on the enemy. I mean, we're talking about them killing literally hundreds or thousands of the enemy with a force of very, very few Americans. Would you like to develop those ideas?
Yes, he. In fact, one of the first things he did when he took over was to have all the commanders rewrite their war plans to take into account that we now had precision-guided weapons that could inflict damage on the enemy that it would take perhaps an army division to inflict before precision weapons came along. So he wanted them to adjust their war plans so they would put fewer boots on the ground and incorporate more air power, more special operations to get the job done. And all the wars that he's fought, and there's been two major wars and then this global war that's going on, he always stresses special operations forces, the SEALs, the Delta Force, the Green Berets, the force multipliers, who can use covert action and stealth, basically, and fast movement, undetected movement, to outflank the enemy and cause destruction, and also to guide air power as to where the targets are. And he believes these are force multipliers that negate the need for huge numbers of ground troops, not no ground troops, but huge numbers of ground troops. And in the end, it saves lives. Now, is he correct? You know, you'd have to say in Afghanistan, in terms of the war there, he was correct, because we won very quickly there. In Baghdad, in the war in Iraq, we won very quickly again in terms of taking down Saddam's regime and getting to Baghdad in about 3 weeks from the moment we left Kuwait. The debate now is over whether his penchant for fewer troops on the ground and more air power and special ops is, did we have enough troops to subdue the country? And I think that's the debate going on now, especially with what's going on in Fallujah. And I think historically we're going to have to look back and judge it. It's perhaps too early right now.
Well, one of the interesting things, there's a lot of interesting things in your book. One of them, of course, is the story of the Gray Fox Unit, which I'd never heard before. But this gets into the NSA, and the NSA is a top secret intelligence organization here in the United States, and they're the ones who have the satellite receivers, and they pull down all the electronic data that is put up by the satellite, so they can read emails and faxes and listen to telephone calls, at least have the computers do all of that, and then screen them afterwards. But what do you do about landlines in other countries where they still transmit over landlines? Would you like to tell the story of the Gray Fox Unit that's been around for a long time that most people have never heard of?
Yeah, it's a very deep cover organization. It's a military organization, not a CIA organization. They're based at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. It's about 200 of them. And their job is to infiltrate countries under deep cover, assume names, assumed identities, and to find landlines, fiber optics, and then to attach equipment to them that can intercept the communications and then feed it to a satellite, or they can just listen in or record it and come back and retrieve the recording device. And this allows us to pinpoint someone it's like the FBI doing a wiretap on a home. This allows us to pinpoint specifically a line of communications that we want to listen to and people we want to listen to, and then and then you know, hopefully discover a good intelligence. So they're used at the discretion of the defense secretary, and they're sort of on their own. I mean, when they go into these countries under assumed names and identities, they're expected to you know, get in there and get out on their own. It's very dangerous work. It's a group of Army people, Air Force people. Most of them are Army commandos, but there are other highly technical people from other services that join in. And they're over in Iraq, and they've been in Afghanistan trying to intercept communications and locate the bad guys.
But, of course, they can go in any country in the world. They're not supposed to, but if you want to collect the intelligence, sometimes you have to sort of ignore international law. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah, they can go in, they can infiltrate a country like a commando does, you know, just go in undetected and do their intercepting of communications and then leave. Or they can go in under an assumed identity, assumed passport, as a contractor or something like that, and then use that cover to go out and find these landlines and dig them up and pierce them and listen. And in both cases, you know, they're on their own, sort of. I don't know of any Gray Fox person that's ever been caught. I mean, not that I know of. It may have happened, but I don't know of it. Because they're very, very good at what they do.
And they certainly are. In fact, I was very surprised to read your book and find out about them. I'd never heard of them before. But then you have a lot of information in your book that the average individual has never known. And you have all of these classified and even sometimes secret documents that somehow or other you were able to get. And you actually published them in the book, including this notation on page 188, which is sort of Rumsfeld's entire plan, his secret plan that lays out very clearly exactly what he intends to do.
Yes. Now, that's a very important document, Dr. Stan, you refer to. He of course, had to battle the uniform people, even after 9/11, to get more involved in the war on terrorism, not just the big battle in Afghanistan, but the under-the-current battle, the special ops stuff in the shadows, the gun-governed areas, where al-Qaeda likes to hang out. And he decided he wanted special operations to do this war down in Tampa, where U.S. Special Operations Command is located in Tampa, Florida. And he got a lot of resistance from the people down there because they were quite comfortable to be a procurement command, essentially a support command, and let the combatant commanders around the world take charge of these missions. So Rumsfeld had to really push and cajole and scold until he got Tampa in the summer of 02 to start to do the war planning he wanted. And he himself sat down, and you refer to the document, and wrote his own war plan with the help of aides for how he wanted the global war on terrorism fought with commandos. And it's like a 7-point plan that he signs on that date, and it talks of using special ops to go in, infiltrate countries, and to kill or capture terrorists, not in a law enforcement mode, but in a military mode. And it also gives them authority to use CIA-type techniques to get their own intelligence so they can be a kind of a one-stop shopping place. And so this, to me, I assert, is the Rumsfeld doctrine in the war about using search and destroy commandos. And it puts aside the old doctrine of using the CIA to fight al-Qaeda. This was something totally new that Rumsfeld was doing.
And, of course, he was going to get permission ahead of time to kill them. In other words, if you can't go into a war and then you wouldn't get there and you say, well, now we got to get permission before we can do anything. They were going to have advanced permission. You're dealing with terrorists who've declared war on America.
Yes.
You're going to go into countries and you're going to kill them. We'll have that you know, advanced permission to do it.
Yeah, well, that document that Rumsfeld signed in July 02, the secret document, I mean, he empowered commandos, the SEALs and Delta Force, to go find al-Qaeda and kill them and not necessarily tell anybody about it. I mean, these are covert missions. Covert meaning deniability. You don't have to tell anyone you did it, and you can deny that you did it. And that's the kind of stuff they're doing out there now.
And right now, we've captured over two-thirds of al-Qaeda leadership. I believe that the organization, at least the highly centralized organization of Osama bin Laden, is pretty well in tatters. My concern is we're developing more and more parallel organizations throughout the world, similar to the one that was just operating over in Spain. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Roman Scarborough. It's a fascinating book, Rumsfeld's War, and we'll invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course with us is Rowan Scarborough, and it's getting pretty late back there and on the East Coast, and I appreciate so much your being willing to stay up with us. But I think that this subject is really so important, and of course you've had an opportunity to talk to the people in the Pentagon. Now, there was tremendous resistance to Rumsfeld and his approach, wasn't there, initially from the military. They just didn't like anybody coming in and going down and saying who was going to be promoted from a 1 to a 2-star general or 2 to 4-star general, or he was really more or less an outsider, and especially he had these ideas that they didn't agree with. They knew how to fight wars, and so what happened when he came in and said this is the way it's going to be?
Well, he got a lot of resistance, of course. He essentially ignored a lot of the top brass. That's one way he got his point across. So they just kind of sat around twiddling their thumbs waiting to know when they were going to go in and brief the new defense secretary, and he didn't call them, at least not for several months, while he got his own advisors in place. And then he was particularly hard on the Army, because he wanted the Navy and the Air Force were kind of doing what he wanted to do. The Navy was looking at faster ways to get their ships to sea, and the Marine Corps was already an expeditionary force. They were light. They could get to the fight fast. The Air Force was pressing ahead with precision-guided weapons and smaller precision-guided weapons so they could carry more bombs on each sortie. But it was the Army that really he felt was not up to snuff. They still were wedded, in his opinion, to a big, huge land force that couldn't get to the fight. And, of course, Kosovo, the 1999 bombing of Kosovo, kind of became a big lessons learned for the Army, because, you know, they wanted to put an Apache squadron or brigade, I guess it was, down on the border with Kosovo, and they just couldn't get it done. They couldn't get to the fight, and they never did. So he wanted the Army to be lighter and more lethal, and he couldn't convince the current leadership to do it. So eventually, at the end, he fired Tom White, who was just the Army Secretary, who was just a terrific person. I mean, a great hero in Vietnam. And he had a very, very cold relationship with General Eric Shinseki, the Chief of Staff, who ultimately retired at the end of his 4 years. And the relationship was so poor that no one from OSD, from Rumsfeld's staff, even attended his retirement party. But once White was gone and Shinseki was gone, he then brought in to run the Army a former snake eater, a commando, Peter Schumacher. And this shows, this is an indication of the type of fighting and war planning that Rumsfeld likes. You know, he likes covert action, light on your feet, lots of clandestine activities. So he brings in this guy Schumacher, a career Delta Force guy, to take over the Army, and now Schumacher is taking the 10 active divisions in the Army, and he's sort of breaking them up into smaller battle groups, into more smaller brigades that can get on planes and get overseas faster. And this is what he wanted to do originally, and he's doing it now.
All right, and of course, one of the interesting things was that Rumsfeld came out against what the Army was doing, was putting women into reconnaissance and other units where they certainly would be in harm's way. And he thinks he's against this because, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Rowan Scarborough. His book is Rumsfeld's War. And he's been describing to us how Donald Rumsfeld was actually able to get his people into key positions, putting what he refers to as a snake eater in as chief of the army. Now, a snake eater is somebody from special forces. The whole idea is that you can take special forces people anywhere in the world and leave them off without supplies. And they know how to live off the land. Even that means they may have to start eating snakes, but they will survive. And that's a very important thing that the average army can't do that, but people from special forces are trained to do it. And I was just commenting how one of the things that I was very interested in is the way he went after this policy they have of feminizing our military and putting women into combat units or trying to get them as close to the front as they can. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, during the Clinton years, there was a, you know, we had this sort of cultural war inside the Pentagon. Clinton wanted to open the military to gays, and he lost that battle, and ultimately ended up signing a law that banned open homosexuality in the military. Then there were new posts open to women. You know, women could now serve on combat ships and in combat aircraft. But they kept pushing the envelope in the Clinton administration, and they ultimately tried to put women into some of these new experimental army units that they're developing out at Fort Lewis, Washington. And one of them was a reconnaissance, reconnaissance ground unit. Well, when the Rumsfeld people took over, Elaine Donnelly, who runs a pro-military group, the Center for Military Readiness, She started making trips to the Pentagon to try to convince them to reverse this, because women are not supposed to be in ground combat. They can be in combat ships and in aerial combat, but not ground combat. And after the Rumsfeld people listened to her make her case, they agreed with her. So they rescinded the order, and they took the women out of these reconnaissance units, which kept, in Mrs. Donnelly's opinion, kept the line in place between women in ground combat.
Now, I'd like to see them out of the combat ships, too, because I think it's totally demoralizing there for a lot of the men. And I think it's, the instance of pregnancy among the women is just, terrible. And then they pulled off the ships, and it's just a tragic situation. No other country in the world, I think, maybe other than Israel has women in combat units. And I'm not even sure Israel has women in combat units. I know the Russians wouldn't even consider doing it.
Well, the Israelis experiment from time to time. And I think they're trying an experiment now with women in certain units, and I'm not sure how it's working, it's a mixed bag. You got to go country by country. Some allow it, some don't. You know, I think the Finnish Navy allow women in submarines, but most navies do not allow women in submarines because of the absolute close quarters that you have to operate in. I mean, it's extremely, extremely cramped, and the feeling in the U.S. Navy is that it just would lead to too much sexual tension to have women in submarines. So we don't have women in submarines. We don't have them in coastal patrol boats either, but we do have them in the larger ships.
Well, we'll see how that works out. But certainly, I believe this was an effort to attack our military from within. I believe that some of the people who are pushing this really did want to demoralize the military. And I'm so pleased that Rumsfeld took a strong position as far as that was concerned. Well, your impression as far as Rumsfeld's effectiveness, has he done a good job in Afghanistan? What about his job as far as the invasion of Iraq? That certainly was very dramatic, one of the most amazing feats of all time.
Yes. Well, yeah, now you have to, with Rumsfeld, I mean, so many big things are going on under his secretaryship that you have to, kind of take them one at a time. So if you look at Afghanistan, I mean, you'd have to say the war plan to take down the Taliban was a terrific war plan. I mean, they did it with very few boots on the ground, and they now have the Taliban scurrying over into Pakistan, and we are making steady, steady progress into having some sort of a democracy in Afghanistan. The flaw there was that bin Laden got out of Tora Bora, and he's still at large somewhere in Pakistan. So I think he gets generally high marks for Afghanistan.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening. If you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to talk to Rowan Scarborough. He works there at the Pentagon as a reporter, knows the people, tremendous amount of information. Feel free to give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Rowan Scarborough. His book, Rumsfeld's War, and is subtitled The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander. And whether the American people want to accept it or not, we are in World War III. We have troops just all throughout the world. There are terrorists out there. There's increasing animosity towards our country. I fear that some of the things we're doing is simply getting more in the way of animosity towards America. But be that as it may, if America is to survive, you have to have people making the decisions, and there's only one way to deal with terrorists, and that's to kill them. Either kill or capture them. And Rumsfeld has certainly laid this out in this secret directive we described a little earlier, where he just talked about giving our forces permission to go in and do what had to be done, and certainly not to talk about it. Now, we actually did take out one of the key commanders of Al-Qaeda there in Yemen a few months ago, didn't we?
Yeah, that was in just before the election of 2002, the midterm election. We were able to get into Yemen because, you know, Bush said in his speech I believe it was the State of the Union in 2002, that, you know, you're either with us or against us. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And that rung true to a lot of governments, and it rung true with Yemen, which had never... not really allowed us to go in there and help them go after Al-Qaeda. So after the Bush speech, Saleh, the president of Yemen, allows us to put boots on the ground to go in and hunt Al-Qaeda and to show him how to hunt Al-Qaeda. And by the fall, we are hunting one of the planners of the 2000 Cole bombing, Abu al-Harthi. And Gray Fox plays a big role in locating the guy, because through some means, and I assume it's through voice printing, we were able to get some sort of a digital read on his cell phone, probably the cell phone number itself. And Gray Fox was able to, at a critical moment, to make that phone emit a signal. And when the phone emitted a signal, that signal can be honed in on, and we have the means to do that at the NSA. And they got a grid, a GPS grid, as to his location, and he was traveling in an SUV convoy. So the CIA has a Predator overhead.
Now, for our listeners, that is a plane, but it's a pilotless plane, and that, of course, is controlled from a great distance away, but they have videos, and they can actually see as if you were the pilot, and somebody's sitting at a television monitor. Whereabouts do we have that center? Do we know?
That's just in CIA. It's at the parking lot at CIA headquarters in a mobile van. And that's where they control the Predator from.
You're talking about in Virginia?
In Langley, Virginia.
Virginia. So they're directing this Predator that's over there in Yemen.
Yes. So they fly it out to this grid point, and they identify the SUV as being Al-Harthi's SUV. So they fire two Hellfire missiles, and they assassinate him. So it was just the perfect kind of operation that Rumsfeld liked. Using intelligence and using drones, unmanned vehicles, and actionable intelligence to take out an Al-Qaeda leader.
And as I mentioned earlier, the reports I get is we've either killed or captured two-thirds of the leadership of Al-Qaeda. Would that be a fair statement, do you think?
Yeah, now that's what the administration says, and some of them we know about. I mean, we know we captured Sheikh Khalid. Let me see,
Khalid Muhammad.
Yes, and we know we got Zubaydah, one of their financial guys. And so in Al-Harthi here in Yemen, we got Hanbali, the bin Laden of Asia. We captured him in Thailand. And then there's other guys we've gotten or captured that they haven't told us about. So we've done a good job of cutting off the head of Al-Qaeda. But we always know that there are these functionaries out there that pop up, like the Spanish operation. And, you know, they can do these ad hoc missions, finding jihadists in certain areas to carry them out. So it's a tough, tough battle. I mean, we're going to be doing this for years, because we let Al-Qaeda and these Islamists, get bigger and stronger over the last two decades. So it's going to take a while to bring them down.
It certainly is. Well, now, of course, you, conclude your book. Before you get to the appendix, with the information about combating future threats. And this is, what is this, a CIA analysis of what's going
DIA.
On? A DIA. A DIA, Defense yes. Intelligence Agency. So you go through what's happening with the various countries. I thought it was a very interesting analysis. Would you like to cover some of the things there about
yes.
Cuba and about North Korea and certainly about Iran?
Well, yes. When I was doing the research for the book, I wanted to write a chapter on future threats. I wanted to have the book looking forward. And I was able to acquire a secret Defense Intelligence Agency report that had never been disclosed before. And it takes people country by country around the world and discloses information about their arsenals and their political stability and their intentions. And there's this is a very, very dangerous world, and there's a lot of troubling things going on. And you just have to look at the Middle East, for example. The DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, predicts that Iran will have nuclear weapons before the end of the decade unless we do something to stop it. And, of course, we already know that they have the missile ranges to reach Israel, and they're working on missiles that can reach Europe. And, of course, ultimately they want ICBMs that can reach around the world. And then for the first time, I disclosed Israel's nuclear arsenal. We don't even acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons, yet this document shows that they have about 80 deployable bombs and missiles. So it doesn't have to take much of the imagination to think what happens if Iran gets nukes. And then there is a war between Israel and Iran. Well, I mean, that would be an absolute catastrophe for the world. So we cannot let Iran get nuclear weapons. The report also shows that North Korea, of course, is continuing to pursue nuclear weapons. It has probably about 4 already at this point, and that they're burrowing deeper and deeper into the ground to hide their weapons programs. And this is one reason Rumsfeld asked for funding from Congress to look into the idea of producing small tactical nuclear weapons that could be attached to some sort of a boring or a burrowing bomb that could go deep inside the terrain before exploding. And this would be the only way we could get at some of these nuclear programs, for example, that North Korea is pursuing, hundreds of feet under the earth. So that's some of the examples of the dangers that are highlighted in this DIA report.
Now, do they talk at all about North Korea's missile capacity? It's one thing to have the nuclear weapons, but
yes.
How do you deliver them? You have to have sophisticated missiles, intercontinental ballistic missiles. It would appear that China is doing everything they can to help North Korea develop the missiles that could be used against America.
Yeah, that's the problem with North Korea. I mean, they're just a massive proliferator. They'll sell drugs, chemical weapons, missiles, nuclear know-how to anybody that has the hard cash to do it, because you know it's such a pathetic economy that one of the only cash crops they have is the WMD proliferation, and then of course China is bent on becoming a nuclear power. And they want to build their new ICBM force, their missiles capable of hitting us, from around 40 today to around 220 in the next 10 to 20 years. And then, of course, they're also developing submarine launch missiles, a capability which will allow them to extend their nuclear threat right off our shores. So we have to watch China, no doubt about it. I mean, they've become a great trading partner. They're a great consumer and exporter, but they also are, we can't lose track of the fact that they are a dictatorship that is whose total intentions are not quite clear at this point, but we know that they want to play a more dominant role in Asia.
Of course, I fear we're creating the best, one of the best enemies our own money could buy, and many of our policies seem to be encouraging our plants, industrial plants, to move over to communist China, and there's no reason in the world why we should ever trust them.
Well, I would not trust them. I would any deal we have with them, we have to verify. China is just a tough, complex problem because they have they go in different directions. I mean, they are embracing capitalism. They're now embracing private ownership of property, but at the same time, they have the People's Liberation Army that plays a very, very strong role in society, and they want to take the country in a somewhat different direction. So we have to watch them. We have to protect Taiwan, which is a thriving democracy, we hope that eventually these reforms that China has embraced will lead unknowingly on their part to democracy, the same way it did in the Soviet Union.
Well, that's like the analogy of feeding a tiger meat, hoping he's going to become a vegetarian. You could always hope, but some people think he just gets stronger and more vicious. Well, one of the interesting things in this section of your book was your analysis of Russia. I mean, we're told Russia now, Russia, communism is dead, there's nothing to worry about, their military is in shambles, we have nothing to worry about from Russia. But in this DIA report, was that the impression you got?
Well, no, Russia is still very much a work in progress, according to the DIA. They're riven with corruption. It's not always certain that they have control over all facets of their nuclear weapon chain of command. They're a project. Russia is definitely a project, and Yeltsin was so corrupt that Putin looks good to us compared to Yeltsin, because Putin does seem to be able to take over the machineries of government and get things done.
But, of course, he is part of the KGB.
He was the KGB, yes,
and
without a doubt.
And his opponents are mysteriously disappearing, people who run for office, and they just disappear. And reporters who are critical of the government, they just disappear. That's the way it was under Stalin.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure how many are disappearing. I know he has arrested a couple of big corporate figures on charges of corruption. But we should lose light of the fact that we now have just ushered in new members of NATO, including Romania, the Baltics. Putin is allowing NATO to expand right on his doorstep, and that's a significant event. He also is participating as a non-NATO member. So these geopolitical shifts take years to play out. And exactly where Russia is headed, we'll probably know. Just like this war on terrorism, we'll have a better idea in about 5 years.
Of course, my concern, and all I know is that the people in Romania and Bulgaria and some of these other countries that are entering NATO are, well, they're all ex-communists. They were communists, but now
yes.
They're no longer. They're just totalitarian socialists. And I wonder if Putin is allowing them to enter or to infiltrate NATO. But time alone is going to tell. I'm just very, very concerned that sometimes the leopard really never does change his spots.
Well, we'll
know in 5 years, as you said.
Yes, we will.
But anyway, of course, right now we're involved in a war on terrorism, and America is not only involved in a war on terrorism, we're also involved in the tragic situation in Iraq, and of course our forces there are under attack, and almost like a war of attrition, isn't it?
Well, it's a very, very ugly battle, very, very gritty stuff, and our men and women over there are be commended for trying to take this Stalinist, corrupt, violent regime and turn it into the Middle East first democracy. I mean, it's an enormous, enormous task. And, I think the problem is that this is where I get, in my book, I give Rumsfeld the lowest grades in this regard, because they really did not anticipate this insurgency when they began the war. And in the book, I have this secret Pentagon report that's never been disclosed before that shows the mistakes that they made in the war planning, and in a nutshell, they rushed it. They'd spent a long time on the war plan itself, but on the plan to take over Iraq after Saddam left, they spent less than 2 months, and they never really did the interagency process correctly. And this did not provide them time to think of the worst case scenarios. So more voices could be heard about, hey, we gotta prepare for this insurgency. Because they were not prepared for the insurgency, they were not prepared for all the looting, and it took them a month to reorganize their forces and bring new people in to do this counterinsurgency. So they lost a lot of valuable time.
You know, of course, we keep talking about wanting democracy, and the Shiites say, fine, we want democracy. One man, one vote. One time, because of course they are 60% of the country. So, we talk about democracy, but there is no democracy anywhere in an Arab country. How can we force democracy on people who have never been able to establish it on their own?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, and maybe we won't be able to do it. I mean, we're trying it in Afghanistan, and we're trying it in Iraq, and there seems to be an educated middle class in Iraq where a majority of the people, even the Sunnis, want to try this. So we're just going to have to set up, we're going to have to set up an Arab-style democracy where we don't allow the Shiites to dominate the country and we don't allow the Sunnis to dominate the country, and we allow the Kurds to have somewhat of their own autonomy up there in the north. And that's what Paul Bremer is trying to work out now.
That almost sounds like more like a republic where you have certainly a decentralization of power at the central level. I think that's a great idea. I just, unfortunately, the Shiites don't think it's a great idea because it's all about power.
Yeah. Well, the Shiites, they're not adamantly opposed to sharing because they control a big, big part of the country and a lot of the key religious sites. I hate to keep saying the same hackneyed phrase, time will tell.
I know, well, but we don't know what's going to happen, and time will tell, and I just hope and pray that those poor, unfortunate people can have some stability and a better life than they had before. Well, let's go to Jeannie calling from Aptos. Hi, Jeannie, how are you doing?
Well, I'm just fine. Today, I listened to a military man talk, and he spoke very highly of Rumsfeld being the CEO of business, and he knew how to be efficient. He said what's coming up in the United States, and I would like this gentleman to comment on what I'm going to say. It's called Guard and Reserve. In other words, it's going to be called the Joint Land Use Policies, where they're going to have striker brigades. They're going to load these men and their equipment on a C-17. And they can go anywhere in the United States within an hour or two in case there is dirty bombs or anything they need to get to fast. Now, these will be used only in the United States. The Guard and Reserve will not go to foreign duty anymore. Do you have a comment on that?
Have you heard of anything of that sort?
Well, no. Well, we know the Guard is the chain of command for the National Guard are the state governors. And so it goes from the president to the defense secretary to the governors. And the guards generally round out the active units that are in the Army and in the Air Force. But the Guard is going to play is playing a big, big role in all our overseas deployment. I mean, most of the there are scores of Guard units now in Iraq, serving as military police, as rounding out armor in infantry divisions, and doing a lot of the support work and intelligence work. And the same goes for Afghanistan. Now, the striker brigades, those are the new wheeled armored vehicles. They're lighter than the Bradley fighting vehicles, and they can get to the fight faster. And they are now, the first striker brigade is now in northern Iraq. They replaced the 101st Airborne Division, which came home to Fort Campbell. And they're sort of the striker brigades, in theory, there's about 310 vehicles, are perfect for this kind of aggressive peace enforcement mission, because the striker vehicles have fairly good protection, and they can move troops quickly around the battlefield, so they're very good in urban areas. Now, in terms of responding to nuclear weapons that are discovered in this country, or to a nuclear weapon or chemical weapon event, the military has a big role in that. They have special units all throughout the military that have specific duties to respond to this catastrophe. And help us that it would ever happen. We hope it doesn't. But they do have a big role domestically in a WMD event.
And I think this is long-range planning, Jeannie. This goes in the National Commission on Terrorism that submitted the report in January of 2001. In fact, the man who headed that commission that talked about, the necessity for military intervention in the United States in case of terrorist attacks was a man named Paul Bremer. If you'd like to read the report, I have it. Give me a call. Anything else, Jeannie?
No, it just says that the Guard and the Reserve are not going to do foreign duty. They're going to be the rapid deployment brigade that will travel all over the United States. So that's what I heard today.
Okay,
so very credible source.
And I'm very concerned about that, but we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
All right.
Thanks so much.
Well, I mean, we know the Guard domestically is called out frequently to do. I mean, they guarded our airports after 9/11. And if there is ever civil disturbances, the Guard is called out to restore order. And in floods and natural disasters, the Guard is called out too. So the Guard is a multi-purpose force. It does domestic work, and then it is also overseas in the war on terrorism.
No, but have we ever before deployed our National Guard overseas?
All the time. In Desert Storm we did.
No, I know, but it seems to me it's only been in recent years. Traditionally, the National Guard was to defend our nation, not for overseas wars.
Well, I don't know the total history, but I know that, the Air National Guard has a number of most of our tankers, our refueling tankers, sit in the Air Guard and in the Air Force Reserve, so that we rely on those squadrons a lot when we are deploying overseas to refuel our jets and to make sure they can make these long global trips. And in Kuwait there were a number of Air Guard units that were used to bomb and strike targets in Afghanistan during that war. So the Guard is multi-purpose, domestic and overseas.
All right, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. So do you have a parting thought for our listeners tonight? Other than the fact that they should get your book, which is Rumsfeld's War, is an excellent book.
The message that I give, and I think this book gives, that we have commenced on a long journey here to fight jihadists. We essentially ignored the problem for 20 years. I'm not being partisan when I say that. We kind of thought it would go away, or we could contain it, or it would every once in a while they would strike and we would arrest people or indict them, and we would handle it that way. And we know that that doesn't work anymore. We know from their literature and from their pronouncements that they want to kill a lot of us, and they want to bring down our Western way of life, our free markets, our democracy, our pluralistic existence. So we have to now fight this struggle, and we can be weary, and we can say maybe this isn't going to work, but we have to persevere. And I try to present Donald Rumsfeld as a guy who realizes that we have to persevere.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for being with us. I really appreciate it. I'm looking forward to your next book.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Good night, and God bless you.
So long.
All right. Well, that was Rowan Scarborough. His book is Rumsfeld's War. I think it's an important book. There is much more to the story, but I think that certainly the book we're talking about, Rumsfeld's War, gives you an excellent overview of what's going on in Washington, D.C. today. To understand what we're talking about a war that will go on for 50 or more years. This is what Donald Rumsfeld has said. They're planning on this war really will never end, or will never end during our lifetimes. Now, how did this whole thing come about? Because remember, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, there wasn't any Islamic movement. There was no worldwide Islamic movement. It all began back in 1979 when Zygmunt Brzezinski, number one, toppled the Shah of Iran and brought the radical Ayatollah Khomeini to power, the first radical Islamic state which we put in power, and then Zygmunt Brzezinski talked Jimmy Carter into beginning to finance the Mujahideen, which were attacking the Soviet puppet government in Afghanistan. And when that happened, voila, why the Soviets invade, now we have a war in Afghanistan. So what does the CIA do? The CIA runs the war. They start printing copies of the Quran, going all throughout the Islamic world, recruiting young Islamic warriors and indoctrinating them in the radical form of Islam that has been pushed only by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a radical group, and of course by the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, and the Wahhabis, a few of them are over in Pakistan. And we've worked very hard to create a radical Islamic movement. Now people say, oh well, we didn't intentionally do that. USAID, United States Agency for International Development, put out $51 million to print textbooks to be used in Afghan and Islamic schools to indoctrinate the youth of that area in the radical forms of Islam. And if you doubt that, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the ABCs of globalism. It's an article out of the Washington Post. Fascinating how we spent all this money to push radical Islamic ideas on the youth of the Muslim nations, but you sure couldn't spend a dollar to push Christianity in a Christian nation, could you? Let me tell you that we created this radical Islamic movement. The CIA is printing and distributing the Quran, and we have created the best enemy that money could buy. And now, lo and behold, it's come back to bite us. Who financed Al-Qaeda and this radical Islamic movement? If you want to know, there's a book called Dollars for Terror, and you could want to learn more about it. Call 1-800-544-8927. It's written by a Swiss journalist, and it was published in 1999. That was 2 years before the 9/11 attack. And he will tell you who financed it. Large part, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan intelligence, which works with the CIA and the CIA. Now we have the enemy. Now we've got to go out and kill them. Who financed the Taliban? Why, the United States government financed the Taliban. Go read George Bush's speech right after the 9/11 attack, and he will tell you the United States was the largest single source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. The largest single source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. We were financing the Taliban. You give money to Afghanistan, you're giving it to the Taliban, and that's a tragic story of how we got to where we are today. And, of course, as our boys go overseas to fight to kill the terrorist, we lose our freedom here at home. But that's an entirely different story. One evening we'll go into the background of the war on terrorism. And, of course, when John Kerry says it's a phony war, everybody knows, of course, that John Kerry can't be trusted. And yet, if you stop and think of it, if we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why haven't we sealed our borders? If we're really involved with the war on terrorism, why has the administration done everything to block the arming of pilots on our planes that would protect us if there were hijackers? Not really reinforce the doors at all. You can break them open with a little cart. Why aren't there marshals on every plane if there's really a war on terrorism? Or is perhaps we're not getting the full story. Well, we're out of time. Please pray for America. Remember our number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And please pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you once again. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask you to hold your calls for the time being because we have with us right now on the line the editor of World Affairs Brief, Joel Skousen. Hi, Joel. How are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Glad I could be with you on short notice.
I really appreciate so much your coming on. This has been a terrible day. I had two people just cancel out at the last minute, one of them with severe laryngitis, and I don't know what the other one reason was, but when that happens, it just ruins your whole day. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on with me. And of course, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
Well, I'd like to cover two major subjects, what's going on in Iraq currently, especially the latest horrendous happenings that have shocked Americans about the killings of the four civilian mercenaries in Fallujah, and also the general plan that we now know the United States is planning to maintain control after the turnover of power in June to the Iraqi Governing Council and how they intend to do it. And I'd also like to talk about what I consider almost a criminal diversion of the American public from the real facts in the 9/11 Commission with all this phony drama surrounding Condoleezza Rice's testimony, whether or not she's going to take it under oath or in public, or President Bush is going to testify, or whether or not there's controversies with Richard Clark's testimony. All of this is so much fol-de-rol when you consider the more meaty matter that they're purposely evading and squandering the limited time that the commission has remaining.
Now, I think you're so right on the Richard Clark issue. I mean, Mr. Clark's book was completely censored by the White House before it was ever released. They knew exactly what he was going to say. In fact, he is not allowed, because of his security clearance, to say anything they don't want him to. He is limited in anything he can reveal. The only thing he can do is criticize the Bush administration for going to war with Iraq, after we had been attacked by Al-Qaeda, which was in Afghanistan. And I think his point is very well made, that there was no justification for going to war with Iraq, because Iraq was not involved with Al-Qaeda and had not been involved in any terrorist activity after 1993. But other than that, I think all the rest of it is a total diversion to take us away from the really important issue. So you pick up the story there, Joel
well, first
played.
Of all, Clark's testimony is only partially genuine. He is playing a partisan role by helping the Democrats undermine Bush by confirming that Bush and other cabinet members had intentions to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, as you said, prior to 9/11. All of that is true. But he continues to foster the false notion that he and others during the Clinton administration were highly focused on Al-Qaeda, and that Al-Qaeda is the primary threat and still a very powerful threat. This is disinformation. In reality, on two counts, first of all, the Clinton administration never during Clark's tenure as counterterrorist czar in the Clinton administration never tried to capture Osama bin Laden, even when any more than the Bush administration, even when the Sudanese government had him in their custody and offered to turn them over to the U.S. for a price. Clark had to have known about this. And on the second point is that Al-Qaeda really is a fraudulent terrorist organization. It simply doesn't meet the criteria of a worldwide powerful terrorist group. So I think it's being used.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen to explore some of these ideas. All right, Joel, we'll just go right ahead and let's get started with Iraq.
Well, while we're on the subject, of course, on the 9/11 Commission, maybe we ought to finish that and backtrack and pick up Iraq.
All right.
But the specifics of, both CBS News and Frontline Special reported that within hours of the 9/11 attack, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was telling his aides to come up and prepare attack plans for striking Iraq. He was overruled in a major cabinet meeting that was covered by Frontline when they said, no, we've got to go after Afghanistan first. It now appears as if the secret Cheney meetings with energy executives of the big oil companies in the White House on energy policy did in fact discuss, according to certain leakers, the fact that they needed to overthrow the Taliban in order to get a pipeline through. And this is probably the reason why Cheney is so adamant about not releasing any records about those conversations. Not only would it show government collusion with major oil companies in doing illegal acts to manipulate energy policy, but it also would give a very strong smoking gun to the fact that the government had ulterior motives for going into Afghanistan. Iraq as well.
Well, because certainly Cheney was tied into Halliburton, which is tied into oil. Condoleezza Rice was on the board of Chevron. The Bush family has been involved in oil for years. Many people refer to this as the oily administration. And I don't think there's any question at all that the war with Afghanistan was not about taking out the Taliban, because we'd financed the Taliban. We'd given them money at many times. We'd supported them. In fact, we were the major source of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan right up until time of the 9/11 attack, and President Bush brought that out in his speech he gave immediately after the 9/11 attack. So we're giving money to the Taliban, but they wouldn't go along with the oil lines, and so that's why we had to have the war, and why we never tried to get Osama bin Laden, because we didn't go into the area to get Osama bin Laden. I have a wonderful book we carry called Crude Politics by Paul Sperry of WorldNet Daily. He points out that the Green Berets and Special Forces who were in Afghanistan were not allowed to go after Osama bin Laden. What does that tell you about the Bush administration's war on terror?
Well, it would be a mistake, though, to simply derive from all of those true statements that you made the concept that oil is the sole motive. As you and I both know, there is a larger, overarching globalist motive.
Absolutely.
And oil is essentially one of the major facilitators of keeping people in line, of making payoffs to people, of enriching insider corporations that support the government globalist agenda.
Go right ahead.
So, currently, there's a lot of talk about whether or not Condoleezza Rice will be allowed to testify in public and under oath. You know, despite the months of wrangling over the concept of whether or not this is a violation of executive privilege or the separation of the powers, it's a safe bet that Rice won't be embarrassed by pseudo-inquisitor chief counsel Richard Benvenista. He's got a bio a mile long that goes back with establishment connections, and almost everyone on the 9/11 Commission panel is a CFR insider. Now, I listened to all of the prior examinations of numerous government officials on NPR radio done by Richard Benvenista. He was playing softball with them all after initial sessions joking and expressing camaraderie between he and the CIA Director Tenet and later with Assistant Secretary of State Richard Armitage, who, of course, as your listeners may know, is a former chief drug importer for the CIA from the Iron Triangle during the Vietnam era. It was clear that no tough questions are going to be forthcoming from Benvenista. Instead of setting up, now here's what you do if you're really going to be a tough attorney, and these people know how to do it. You see them in the courtroom all the time. They set up legal traps in advance by asking seemingly innocuous questions or details that are unrelated to where the official thinks they're going, gets them to get on record and under oath of saying certain things, and then comes back and traps them with those answers and shows contradictions with things that they've already revealed in other testimony or in other public statements. And none of that occurred whatsoever. He simply continued to use hours of time asking them questions that these officials could easily evade by either claiming ignorance or I don't have this at hand to be able to discuss with you, I'll have to get back to it later, or claiming national security. And then Benvenista failed to present any contradictory testimony later on all about that. So, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, he is only one of the 10 members on the committee, but I've read a lot of...
Oh, but he's the chief counsel. He's the one who does the interrogating.
Right. But, of course, they all ask questions.
Yes, but he's the one who leads and directs and is supposed to really do the grilling. You know, this is the same role that Art Inspector approved during the Warren Commission. They have every... same that Ken Starr showed, although he had FBI agents actually playing that role. He rarely showed up at his own commission in the Vince Foster cover-up. But generally, these chief counsels of these investigative commissions are supposed to take the lead, and they are always rewarded by covering up for what they are hired to do. And you'll see Richard Benvenista probably be a congressman, senator someday, and rise within the ranks.
Just like Arlen Specter, the Warren Commission became Senator Arlen Specter.
That's right.
And, of course, Gerald Ford, who was on the commission, he became President Gerald Ford.
You know, there's dozens of general explanations that Rice can come up with to explain the contradictions between her former statements to the press and the testimony of Richard Clark. But even if Benvenista was able to make something of the difference, what would it show? It would show that the U.S. was either negligent, incompetent, worked in cross purposes with other agencies, or heaven forbid, that it just failed to share information with other agencies. So you see what I'm saying about this particular diversion, even if everybody's guilty of what they're aiming at, so what? These are not faults that merit more than a slap on the hands. It's no wonder that no government officials responsible for security intelligence have been fired. By focusing the public's eye on these innocuous, dramatic, non-dramatic issues, really, the public is denied the key issues that cry out for explanation. And, you know, we've discussed that in previous shows, the fact that there is evidence of explosions that went on prior to the collapse of these buildings, setting the stage for their collapse in 9/11. That needs to be investigated. Nothing is being done in the 9/11 Commission to do that. There's, of course, the planted too-good-to-be-true evidence, the magic passport, and the fact that none of these people could fly Cessna airplanes, let alone these very sophisticated aircraft, the refusal of government to produce tape and video evidence that would corroborate the official version and identify conclusively the list of hijackers, of which we know that 7 are still living and 9 were either missing or dead before the fact. I mean, this is just incredible. The lack of evidence, the things that this 9/11 Commission could do of substance, and we simply have a show, almost like a circus, going before the public as a diversion.
And I was just commenting with Insight Magazine, carried an article about 7 of the 9/11 hijackers who were alive and well over in the Middle East. But, of course, you didn't never read about that in your regular newspaper.
That's right, and you know, one of the most important things, of course, is that air traffic control tape records all conversations between pilots, and they certainly would have monitored all of these flights as the hijacking occurred, and they have the the 9/11 Commission said they were going to subpoena these tapes, recordings from the FAA, and we never heard anything more about it. They failed to do so. But, you know, fortunately, we have an abbreviated sample from the leaked private ATC transcript. And what happened, this had to do with Flight 93. There was a private Learjet that was flying in the air that was under Cleveland Center ATC control, as well as United 93. There was American Flight 1060. There was a couple of United flights in the air, and they were all listening, of course, on the same frequency. Anyone flying within Cleveland Center's sector of operations is on the same frequency as talking to Cleveland Center, and they give them various directions and tell them where traffic is. And all of a sudden, there comes this screaming and yelling in English and Arabic over the radio in the common frequencies. And Cleveland Center says, didn't understand, repeat your call, and he didn't get an answer, and so Executive 956, a private jet, says, Cleveland Center, just answering your call, we could hear that too, there was yelling and screaming on the radio. Cleveland Center's okay, thank you, we're just trying to figure out what's going on. I'm reading from the transcript for your listeners. Then United 93 actually comes on the radio and says, this is the captain. Please sit down. Remain seating. We have a bomb on board. Now, what's happened here is that this pilot's obviously in very great distress. He's pressed the wrong button on the pilot's yoke. You have a button for the intercom, and you have a button for the radio to talk to ATC or whoever you've got dialed into the frequency. And he obviously keyed the wrong button, saying this is the captain, you know, thinking he's talking on the intercom when he's broadcasting to everybody who's on the Cleveland ATC Center. So Cleveland Center responds, calling Cleveland Center, you're unreadable, say again slowly. Nothing comes back. Executive 956, the jet, the private jet says, sounded like someone there said there was a bomb on board. Cleveland Center responds, that's what we thought, just trying to get it clear. United 93, understand you have a bomb on board. Go ahead. Executive 956, did you understand that transmission? 956 responds, affirmative. He said there was a bomb on board. Cleveland Center later on says, it's a female controller taking over from the male controller. Do you see any activity on your right side, smoke or anything like that? Executive 956, and he's an American 1060 responds and says, negative, we're searching. Then he says, yeah, we do have a puff of smoke now, or about 2 o'clock. There appears to be just a spire like a puff of smoke. Now, this is evidence that there was an explosion in the air. Now, this transcript has been out now for several months on the Internet. Obviously, this is ATC control. They have this transcript. The FAA has had this transcript. Why hasn't the government ever mentioned? Now, personally, I think what happened, there really wasn't a bomb on board. I think the terrorists used that as an excuse for hijacking. But in fact, what happened is, because we have other evidence that two F-16s were vectored to Flight 93, and other witnesses on the ground saw missiles going toward the aircraft. We had the engine separating from the aircraft. It would be very unlikely, due to the distance of the engine from the fuselage, that a bomb on the airplane that didn't destroy the whole airplane when it went off, which it obviously didn't, would not have had sufficient force to knock an engine off the end, but certainly a missile would have. Now, there could have been both a bomb and a missile taking it down. But in any case, you had suitcases strewn out along the path before it crashed, as well as an engine dropping off miles before the crash site. So obviously something is going on here, and the government is hiding this. These are things that, I mean, if we know about it, certainly the 9/11 Commission, with all their millions of dollars and professionals, should be discussing these issues, should be talking to Condoleezza Rice about these things instead of asking her about daily briefings from the president, which obviously, as long as they stay within the confines of things that are secret and top level at the White House, any one of those people can simply say, I can't talk about it, I can't say, I can't do, and what can the 9/11 Commission do? But how can they refuse when they, if they hauled before them the head of the FAA and read this transcript, How could they refuse to answer these things? You see, this isn't the proper way to trap these officials, and they're not doing it.
Well, I think that the purpose of the 911 Commission is to give the American people the idea that they're really trying to get to the bottom of this, and they're not at all. I think they're playing games with our minds, because the thing that would be if the American people ever really considered the fact that they knew the attack was going to occur, and they did nothing about it, and that they actually shot down that plane in Pennsylvania, which all the evidence suggests that they did, why the American people would be furious. And, you know, why can't they just tell the truth? I don't think they would dare tell the truth, because it would lead to the impeachment of people in Washington, D.C., and they would be tried and executed for treason against this country. If they knew that attack was coming and did nothing about it, how could you justify it? You could not. Any more than Dick Cheney, the vice president, can justify knowing or suspecting an anthrax was attack was going to come, starting himself and his entire staff on Cipro the night of the September 11th attack, and never telling anybody else that he knew or suspected that attack was coming. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen from WorldNet Brief, and we're talking about what the 911 Commission is doing or not doing, and I was expressing my opinion that this is simply to keep idle minds busy, to keep our attention focused on all the wrong issues, and certainly never to try to get to the truth.
Yes, I would certainly agree, Dr. Stan. It's going to have a predictable outcome. They'll issue some statements critical of the United States government, but it will be simply slap on the hand in the fences with the conclusions that we need more money, that they need to share information more with each other, and so this doesn't happen again. But high-profile events will happen again, we certainly will be driven towards more knee-jerk patriotic reactions to curtail our liberties in the name of this, what I consider a phony war on terrorism.
Well, you know, it was very interesting how the timing of the attack in Spain was just a couple of days before the election. And that actually was able to drive that election, replace the government with a strongly leftist or pro-socialist government that replaced the government of Spain. And you wonder if they might consider doing something similar here in the United States in the days immediately before our next election.
Well, you've got to remember that, at least this is my analysis, that I don't think that they want Bush replaced. So, and I guess that would play into Bush's hands to have another terrorist attack. But you'd have to be careful with it. You know, if you had another terrorist attack where government really made it look bad, Kerry could come forward and say, you know, this administration really is incompetent. So there may be a case for not having something. But there certainly may be a case for creating some terrorist incidents that will continue to keep people believing that terrorism is a threat. And it doesn't have to be in the United States to do that. The U.S. continued to make a case for terrorism based upon the Madrid train attacks. In fact, they began to put forward several half-hearted solutions for securing the nation's trains, which are almost impossible to do that. People get on and off of commuter trains in such rapid succession that there's no way to have the kind of baggage and checks that you have individually at the airport when you have everybody getting on and taking an hour and a half, essentially, to put a plane into operation and to get it loaded and to get it in the air. So, in any case, it's hard to read how they'll do this. I am convinced, however, that the powers that be want George Bush reelected. They particularly picked one of the Democratic candidates that is the least electable, that has the most contradictory positions that can be made to look unpresidential and untenable coming electoral months.
Well, it's going to be very interesting as we see this scenario unfold, as these two members of Skull and Bones fight it out for the presidency.
Or play like they're fighting.
Play like. Well, of course, it's all make-believe. It's about time the American people understand that the Council on Foreign Relations, their people surround George Bush, John Kerry comes from the Council on Foreign Relations, both men come from Skull and Bones, that has stronger cult links, and you would think that statistically it would be very improbable to have two Skull and Bones candidates running against one another. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Joel. Well, Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen, who is the editor of World Affairs Brief. Joel, would you like to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and get copies of your weekly directive or weekly publication?
Yes, the World Affairs Brief does come out weekly. It's my news analysis service where I discuss the major issues each week and what goes on behind the scenes, the media is particularly leaving out, and what government is evading telling the people. You know, it isn't so much, as I've said before, that people or that the media outright lies about things. They distort the news by selective omission of critical issues and critical truths. And that's the way the government operates as well. That's why they're able to focus on patriotic reactions to terrorism and other man-made conflicts so that they can induce them to accept solutions they would not normally induce. That's what I do in the World Affairs Brief, and it does come out weekly for those that get that subscribe by email or through the Internet. They can check that out on my website, which is www.joelskousen.com, J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N, joelskousen.com. Now, there also is a print edition for those that haven't got up to the modern age yet on the Internet or email. It is also weekly editions, but they don't get typeset in print and sent out till the end of the month. And it is more money because of postage and typesetting and printing. But you can get copies of the printed edition of the World Affairs Brief by calling my office during working hours, area code 801-224-4746.
All right, fine. Now, is there anything else you wanted to cover as far as the 911 Commission is concerned?
No, I think we've pretty well covered that. Let's move on to Iraq.
All right. And certainly this is a tragic picture we saw, I guess it was last night or the night before, of the murder, a shooting, the burning of these four men, these four whether they were mercenaries or anyway, there were four non-Arabs who were over there and then dragging them through the streets and hanging them from a bridge. So obviously this is just gross brutality.
Well, you know, this is what we saw reenacted in Israel a few years ago with the Israeli army soldiers that were caught and what most, you know, they were thrown out of a window, and then they were beat and chopped up and clothes torn off, and they were skinned alive, and then their entrails eviscerated and dragged through the streets. And the Palestinians were very, very careful to make sure they tried to harass and keep any of the foreign reporters from reporting the kind of savage, bestial behavior that they did against the Israeli soldiers. But we've seen something happen now with the Iraqis, the Sunnis, in Fallujah. Fallujah is about 25 miles west of Baghdad. It's a stronghold of Sunni opposition. It enforced the major military force surrounding Fallujah, the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, which replaced the Army's 82nd Airborne Division there. But even the Marines don't go into Fallujah because it's so dangerous right now. They said that they will go back in and restore order, but they'll pick the time and the place. But obviously, that bravado by the Marine commander is indicative that they don't dare put a lot of random patrols in there. But these were apparently, and we know now who these four were, they were mercenary employees of Blackwater Security Consultant. Now, this is a division of Blackwater USA. The company's website claims we've established a global presence and provide training and tactical solutions for the on behalf of government for the 21st century. They own over 6,000 acres of private land in Virginia and North Carolina, and they provide training of in all kinds of weapon systems for other governments around the world, as well as the United States government. They've trained everything from Palestinians, like the CIA trains Palestinians on how to, you know, become terrorists, as well as other people from Latin America especially. And these were four of the security consultants, as they are called, but they were actually mercenaries in Iraq doing private security there within Fallujah and other protection services.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen and continue this discussion of the significance of what has only recently occurred as these four mercenaries were brutally murdered there in Fallujah. So we'll be back in just a moment with Joel Skousen. Of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan Mack here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. Joel, pick up the story from there.
You know, Dr. Stan, it never ceases to amaze me that how many of these black ops mercenary companies there are out there. I mean, the United States government does so much of their dirty work now through these mercenary companies, whether it's MPRI, whether it's DynCorp, whether it's Vannelli Corporation or Vicente Corporation or Blackwater Security or Steel Foundation that was involved in Haiti and Aristide. I mean, these companies number in the hundreds, and the amount of contracts the U.S. puts out on these people are just in the billions of dollars. Now, we might ask ourselves, why? What are they doing over there? What have even four mercenaries would be really stupid to go into Fallujah with only four people in a vehicle. I mean, the military doesn't go in there without a convoy of troops and without some heavy armor to stop these attacks from occurring. So I don't know the exact mission of what they were doing, but apparently they were not heavily armed, and which means that they were probably trying to keep a low profile, whatever they were doing, you know, within the city. But what this means, you know, I want to comment, though, on these mercenary companies that the U.S. uses. These are really quite illegal in terms of what they're allowed to do. You know, if you or I to apply to do some kind of private security company, you want to have access to military weapons and rockets and explosives and helicopter gunships, and you wanted to be able to have use of military airports. Can you imagine what the government would say to you or the ATF if you requested that kind of permission to use and buy that kind of equipment?
A lot of these people are actually ex-special forces, aren't they?
They're all ex-military people. In fact, the ex is really rather questionable. What I'm trying to say by the question that I propose to you, Stan, is that none of us, if we were legitimately in the private security business, could get permission from government to do what I just described, especially use military facilities and to have automatic weapons in a combat mode and buy hundreds of these weapons. And we're not talking just about a few AK-47s or M-16s or the modern Stormer versions, etc. We're talking about rocket launchers. We're talking about explosives, grenades, everything that the military has, including more. You find these military people, these black ops mercenaries actually using...
Hold that thought right there.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and he's talking about these mercenary units. There are all sorts of them that he said there are literally hundreds of these, and they're really made up of ex-Special Forces people who are probably not ex-Special Forces at all. They're heavily armed with grenades and rocket launchers. Now, you and I, as Joel points out, we couldn't go out and get automatic weapons and rocket launchers and grenades, but these privately funded organizations can, and there are a lot of them that are out there supposedly being used for guarding and things of that sort, whereas I think that they're really all undercover CIA operations. This is exactly what Rumsfeld wants. He wants these private organizations. He wants to be able to get these special forces in everywhere in the world, and of course he can't put them in a military uniform, so they're coming in under another guise. Would you agree with that?
Well, the proof, though, that these are seamlessly integrated with the military, like MPRIs working in Macedonia, they were helping the guerrillas, and the U.S. was supposedly on the side of the Macedonian army, but the MPRI was using Predator aircraft. These are controlled by the CIA or the U.S. Air Force, depending on what version of it. And they were getting downloaded data links and photographs of the Macedonian forces so that the MPR people who were advising the guerrilla forces, the NLA, which was a version of the KLA from Kosovo, so that they could, you know, play havoc with the poor Macedonian army.
Well, no,
you don't get seamless coordination with a Predator aircraft, top secret type aircraft, and data link with that unless you're working the same as the U.S. military government. You don't get to use military air bases to land and operate out of unless you're, in essence, a seamless operation with the U.S. military.
But don't you think that they have always done this? CIA has always had front organizations, so to have plausible deniability as they carried out their black ops. What you're suggesting, these are black operations, are government black ops, but we just don't want the American people to know. I'm sure that everybody in every other country knows who they are,
and
we just don't want the American people.
There's a difference, Dan. They have, all throughout the 80s, they used mostly military people and swore them to secrecy. They used normal military pilots and other things to go in and do these black operations. They had too many whistleblowers. They had too many people saying, this is illegal, we don't like doing this, this is bad stuff. And now what they've done, they've taken corrupt military people, sheep-dipped them or got them out of their military. They still, you know, transfer them to these secret organizations that play like the private, and technically they are private. They have private corporate mandates, et cetera, but they get all of their money funding and direction from U.S. government operatives, and so they're just an extension of the U.S. government. You are correct in saying that this is to establish plausible deniability, but the primary reason is so that you avoid the whistleblower problem when you had to use ordinary military people and swear them to secrecy. They have too many whistleblowers. And this way, you have predictable, unprincipled people who couldn't care less. There's lots of those in the military, you know. I am not one of those that goes around saying I support our troops. I've been a military officer. I know that some of them are good, and a lot of them are bad, and a lot of them are unprincipled, and a lot of them are low class. And that's why we have friendly fire. That's why we have so many rapes of women in the military. I mean, there are all kinds in the military service. So I do not give blanket approval just because there are troops. I make my judgment specifically. It isn't to say there aren't some really wonderful people. But even the wonderful ones have to be a little blind to go along with some of the things they see in the military and in government, you know, and can come home pretending that this is all for patriotism, because it certainly is anything but that. I mean, one of these mercenary companies was reported by the Army Times as using an experimental new explosive bullet just to test it out there in Iraq, and it hit someone in the buttocks and blew away his whole entrails and everything. I mean, it was just an explosive reaction. Now, a U.S. soldier using one of those bullets would have been court-martialed, of course, but you use these black ops people, and, you know, they don't have any principles, they don't have any rules of engagement. They're simply they are black ops. Anyway, what I'm trying to get at is that what's the larger story, of course, about the Fallujah thing is that this is indicative of a great deal of hatred growing against the United States in the Sunni region. There are, to be sure, regions in Baghdad in which the American troops are popular, and there are regions in which they are not so popular. But it is clear from my analysis that the United States intends to have a heavy-handed presence in Iraq for many years, even under the so-called transitional government that they are preparing. And it's going to be truly a puppet government. Some of the details have just come out recently about what the U.S. is intending to do there. And if we have some time, I could go through some of those.
Go right ahead. We've got about 20 minutes, Mark. So go ahead.
Well, there was an interview that took place with recently with one of the primary members of the Iraqi Governor Council. His name was Adnan Pakhachi, and this was last Sunday, in fact, and he has really spilled the beans. I would be surprised if he remains on the Iraqi Governor Council. Bremer can't be very pleased with what he has leaked out about what the U.S. is planning, as it supposedly, in over a little over 100 days, passes the mantle of sovereignty to the Iraqi government. But in any case, he says, we're not going to enter into any big contractual obligations, either diplomatic or economically. We won't have the power to do that. He says that his session, we're just, in essence, we're going to be simply a figurehead government. The Bremer administration, for example, has named all of the head agency people who will run all of the cabinet ministries, who will run all of the various agencies of government, and none of those people can be removed by this new Iraqi governing council that will be put into place. They don't know what the form is that it's going to be, but it really won't have any powers to pass any laws to change anything up until the time that they have this major election in December or January of next year. Let's see what else he said. He said that, of course, the United States is going to go through the facade of change where they'll start to use an ambassador now. The Bremer will be replaced by an ambassador, but none of Bremer's team is going to be replaced. Bremer, in fact, will stay in country to advise the ambassador. It really means then that the ambassador is going to be a figurehead. He says that of the 25 ministers that are going to rule the country under the new provisional government, he says all of them will be holdovers selected by U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer. These are the following three options that Pakhachi has said that they're considering for the country's interim government. One, either a committee selected by U.S.-picked governing council with occupation authorities authority over the following. A 25-member council where the monthly rotation of the presidency right now in the Iraqi Governing Council, they rotate the presidency every month. That will be jettisoned. There will be a permanent president. They're trying to get Ahmed Chalabi to be that president. That's who the U.S. really wants to control Iraq. He's the perfect puppet.
But nobody in Iraq wants him, do they?
Well, yes, there is a small faction, but he's got very, very little support in Iraq. But they figure if they can give him 6 months there as head of the of state, that he'll have enough popular clout that they can manipulate the election results to get him elected. And they would have to manipulate, to be sure. They're also thinking about expanding the governing council to 100 members and give them some kind of parliamentary role, electing a prime minister and a president. But still, they won't have any power to actually change the laws until a fully elected government is elected. Now, I don't think option number two of expanding to 100 members is really the way that they'll go. I think they'll go fewer rather than more. They want to concentrate on making popular the people around Ahmed Chalabi. Or they could have a national governing council convened under UN auspices. The UN is lobbying for this. They want to choose minister and prime ministers with some legislative and advisory power, And there's a United Nations team that's arriving at the end of the week that will try to work out the technical aspects of their proposal. However, Pachacci says that there really isn't much enthusiasm within the Burma government to allow the UN to have its way there. I think they're going to simply allow them to feel like they're part of the process. So, as I predicted, a couple of months ago in my World Affairs brief, I think the U.S. does intend to maintain control there. They're certainly going to maintain control of the military bases. The Iraqi governing commission that will take over in June, nor the elected government will have any power to control those six major military bases in Iraq.
You're speaking now, we're going to keep American forces there more or less permanently.
Yes, I think the U.S. wants a major Middle East presence. I think that they are concerned that they're going to be losing what they have in Saudi Arabia due to social unrest. The House of Saud is very, very unstable. It's got hundreds and hundreds of princes and divisions of powers. A very leftist prince that is going to rise to power probably when the current King Fahd dies. So I think that we're going to have a very unstable Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. is preparing to maintain that presence by military forces in Iraq.
Well, I think that we need to have that oil under our control. I think that we have to have a continued military presence there. We're developing apparently bases in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and all of those very Stan countries over there. So we've got our forces in Afghanistan, Iraq, and at least three or four of the those Central African Muslim nations. So we're going to have a continued presence there and dominate the oil of that area. Apparently, there's going to be real problems with China using so much oil now. There's really going to be a relative shortage, and if whoever controls the oil really is going to control the industrial world.
Well, and as you might have heard, OPEC's going to cut production by 4%, or at least so they say. That remains to be seen if any one of those oil, if the majority of those oil companies will abide by this ruling. Traditionally, a lot of people don't realize that OPEC companies or countries have cheated on their quotas. And Saudi Arabia simply has had to cut production by more than 4% to make up for those that are cheating. These countries are in bad shape economically. They have promised too much in the welfare state that they use in all of these countries, and they simply cannot afford the lack of revenue, even though prices tend to go up. They still need revenue by selling lots of oil.
Well, it's really very interesting that we're increasingly now, 25 years or so after Three Mile Island, we're beginning to talk about, well, maybe we're going to have to return to nuclear energy in this country as they have elsewhere. And since it works very efficiently in most countries, why can't we do it here? Of course, we should have asked that question 25 years ago, but it's almost as if they've transferred the control of the nuclear energy program to the establishment, and now that they can create a crisis and say, gee, we're going to have to go back to nuclear energy. As the people who ran it before, of course, lost everything.
That's absolutely true.
And that's how the game is played. Things go from weak hands into very, very strong hands. And you may have $100 million invested in a nuclear plant, but when you're playing with these big boys, why, that really doesn't mean much of anything.
That's right. Yes, certainly.
All right, fine. Well, then, it's certainly, as far as Iraq is concerned, I agree with you totally. We're going to keep our troops over there. We can't let the American people know that's the plan. We certainly can't let them suspect that we went in there for oil. And as you pointed out, and I agree with you totally, this is part of the move towards the New World Order. And my fear is that, of course, it's eventually going to result in a confrontation that's going to result in a major war that's going to have disastrous consequences. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, certainly. I think we are looking for major Middle East unrest in the future, and as I say, I've always felt that eventually it will be the primary trigger for World War III.
Well, it's really very interesting. Have you ever read Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations?
I haven't really read it. I've, of course, heard about it.
It's well worthwhile reading. I just got it to read it because I felt that this might very well explain what's going on. It really does. Samuel Huntington tells you what you need to do to have peace in the world, and we've done exactly the opposite from everything he advocated. And he points out that if we break up Western civilization, if we try to go into the Arab countries and remake them the way that we think they ought to be, if we go to war over there, we'll actually bring all of the Arab countries against the United States and precipitate a major war. The book is endorsed by both Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski, and it is a Mein Kampf basically on what should be done to preserve world peace. And as they say, we have done everything exactly the opposite from what Samuel Huntington advocates. The book was originally published as an essay in Foreign Affairs magazine for the members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I believe this clash of civilizations did not just happen. I believe it was planned that way.
Well, certainly the Kissingers and the Brzezinskis of the world have been fomenting the clash of civilizations, so that always leads to an interesting question of why they should be endorsing this warning by Huntington.
Well, I think that they're maybe letting the insiders understand exactly what's happening, because there is no way we could have made all of the mistakes that we have made unintentionally. I don't believe that people in charge are that foolish or that stupid. And Samuel Huntington warned that if we went over there and started to interfere in the internal affairs of those countries, we were going to antagonize the Arabs. If we went to war over there, we would bring a 1.5 billion Arabs down on us, because there was this kin relationship, and they would look upon an attack on any Arab nation as an attack on all of Islam.
I think it's instructive to note, though, that Brzezinski has often taken positions in opposition to what he did when he was National Security Advisor. Just like Alan Greenspan is now issuing a lot of cautions about things which will surely come to pass in the economy, and that's preparing the way so that he can say, "I told you so," when the thing finally comes unraveled. These people want to be on both sides of the fence, promoting the evil that they do and then warning of it just before it happens, so that they can once again take leadership and claim to know, what the proper direction the nation should take.
Well, that's exactly what's happened, because even though I believe Brzezinski is the maker or architect of everything that's happening at the present time, he has written a new book that says exactly what you say, warning against our policies in Iraq. We'll be back here in just a moment or two to wrap up this evening's program with Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening has been Joel Skousen. We've had a fascinating discussion, first of all on the 9/11 Commission, and then of course on the mercenary units that are really being used throughout the world, but certainly are being used in Iraq. Private armies, I'm sure the CIA, but I'm sure they tie in very strongly to Donald Rumsfeld and his plan to use special op operations in foreign countries, but nobody's to understand what they're doing, because these people have a license to kill. And they can, once they're in there, according to the Rumsfeld Doctrine, they go in, they kill whoever they want to, and when they do it, they're on their own. But they really have the blessings of people in our government. So would you like to sort of wrap up this evening's program, Joe? We've got about 2 minutes before we have to let you go.
Well, you know, we've been talking tonight about how we believe that the 9/11 Commission is engaging in a major cover-up of government collusion with the events of 9/11, just as there was a major cover-up in TW-800 and the Vince Foster murder and the JFK assassination, the RFK assassination, all of these major events that proved to be Hegelian turning points in our society, creating conflict that induced a change in the public that they would not otherwise have accepted were it not for the martyrdom and death of certain people.
Don't forget Waco. Don't forget the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yes. Certainly, they're becoming legion now, and it's a very predictable process. Now, the High Court this week has denied access to photos of the Vince Foster death, claiming, interesting enough, that they recognize a survivor privacy right to be protected by the law, calling upon the requesters, those who want the photos, they must prove first government wrongdoing before agencies will disclose these images. images of the body. But you see, the images of the body are the best evidence of government cover-up and wrongdoing. That's why they want the photographs, so they can prove the case that government, in fact, did cover up the fact this could not have been a suicide. And yet the court is saying, in order for you to break through the survivor privacy right of the family, you have to prove government wrongdoing.
Yeah, I don't recall reading about that in the Constitution any place when I read it, but I suppose they just created a new right that nobody ever recognized before.
Well, you know, it's not just the photos of the body. It's the photo of the body in the position that they found it at the park, and the fact that it was moved to a different location, the fact that there was almost no blood coming out of the body, which is just unlike a person taking his own life.
Joel, we're out of time. God bless you, and thanks so much for being with us. We got real problems in America. We have to keep focused on our Lord.
All right. Thank you.
Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Joel Skousen. Of course, we talk about all of these things, but we're really involved in a spiritual battle, which is being fought on a political and ideological and a cultural battlefield, and most people don't understand that behind everything going on today is that eternal battle between good and evil that began in the Garden of Eden and will be continued until our Lord comes again. But behind the various people and the various organizations we talk about are secret societies. The Council on Foreign Relations, which, according to Richard Harwood in an article in the Washington Post back in 1993, and we'd be glad to provide that for any of you out there who'd like to see it. He was the ombudsman for the Washington Post. The Council on Foreign Relations is about the closest thing we have to a ruling establishment here in the United States. And he simply points out how in 1993 the president was a member of the CFR, the secretary of state was a member, the deputy secretary of state, five assistant secretaries of state, the legal counsel for the State Department, all came from the Council on Foreign Relations, as did so many of our cabinet heads, as did the director of the CIA, as always, that was his word, not mine, as far as the chairman of the Federal Reserve System, how they controlled the positions of power in the Clinton administration, how they controlled the media, the right side of the media, the left side of the media. And unless you understand that the Council on Foreign Relations, organized in 1921, is a front for another secret society which is rooted in the occult, you can't understand anything going on today. What is the purpose of the Council on Foreign Relations? To create a one-world government and a new world religion. And what is that religion? Why, it will be the religion of the Antichrist, headed by the false prophet. At that point, you can begin to understand what's going on today. If you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, you say, well, this may be so much psychobabble, but I've been at this for over 40 years now, and the longer I live, the more convinced I am that God does rule in the affairs of men, and that there is this great spiritual battle. And we have the research going into the background of the Council on Foreign Relations. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the video, you need to get it. And it will give you insight into what's going on. And the book you can read in 4 hours, and I promise it will change your life, and it will change the way you look at the world. So if you'd like to know more about the book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to know more about why we're really in Iraq, why you'll want to get a copy of our March newsletter, where we simply quote from the book by Paul O'Neill. Paul O'Neill was Secretary of the Treasury, and in his book on page 96, he tells what happened at the secret cabinet meetings in January and February of the year 2001. That was 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack. You'll be fascinated about what Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz were talking about. They were talking about going to war with Iraq, even before the 9/11 attack. And what was it all about? Why, the Defense Department had laid out all the plans on how to divide up the oil of Iraq. If you'd like a free copy of my newsletter with simply quotes from Paul O'Neill's work, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-8927. HIV War. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of the March newsletter. And then, of course, we hope you'll want to get more information on what's going on. You go to our website at radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs 5 hours a day. That's www.radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell people about our programs. We're on shortwave 4 hours every day, and people who don't have a computer can get us on shortwave. And then we hope you'll pray for America. You'll pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, we're going to lose this country. We ask you to pray for our ministers, for our leaders. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.